You're listening to the Punk News Podcast, episode 209. Punk News Podcast. My name is Adam White. I'm recording for you in Niagara Falls, Ontario. Joining me on tonight's show, we have really the seniors in the room with us, the old folks, the elders of the Punk News universe, at least as far as the podcast is concerned, I suppose. I don't even really know where I'm going with this. John Gentile in Philadelphia, PA. Hi, John.
Hello, Sonny.
And Mr. Greg Simpson in wherever you moved, whatever state you moved to.
I'm still in Indiana, Lafayette, Indiana. Yeah, home of Purdue.
Purdue.
It's big for people that like sports, I guess. I don't know. So is Bloomington, but you've never heard of that either.
Yeah, you know where else is big for people that like sports? New York City, Greg.
Well, us Midwesterners, we have to cling to stuff a little less substantial, I suppose.
I'm not entirely convinced that any of the places that you mentioned actually exist.
I'll send you directions. You can come over and visit.
Now, I'm pretty sure there's a Lafayette in New York.
There's a Lafayette, Pennsylvania.
Yeah, there's probably a lot.
There's a Lafayette, New Jersey.
It's quite a few Bloomingtons, too.
Yeah, you just keep moving to these, like, nondescript Springfield towns that, you know, exist everywhere and don't actually have an identity of their own.
Springfield towns, yeah. Well, I am a Simpson, so I guess I have to be from a town that could be anywhere.
That is very true. All right, so, hey, we're going to talk about punk news things that happened over the past week and comment on them as we do. First of all, though, let's just talk about stuff because I'm all full of happenings here and I need to figure out how we're going to process all of these. So first of all, news aside, let's talk about this anniversary that we've decided that we're going to celebrate. It's apparently several years after 1994. And we have thus decided that... enough time has passed since 1994 that we should make a big fucking deal about it. So we are. So it is the 20 years since that hallowed time during the, I don't know, is this the Clinton administration at this point?
Yes.
Yeah,
there we go. So I don't know. I was young. I feel like I was young. I feel weird retrospecting stuff when I was that young because then it sort of comes out how young I was, and it doesn't sound like I'm allowed to have much of an opinion about it, I guess. But we do, because that's what we're doing. Do any of you want to actually reveal how young you were in 1994?
Sure. I was 9. No, I was 11. I was 11. I was 11.
I was 13.
I was, depending on when we were in the year, either 11 or 12, I guess. So, all right. So, yeah, we were all around the same general age at that point, you know, blossoming into young adults.
But see, that's like the perfect age for you to kind of, starting to form your own personality and, you know, break away from whatever your, you know, parents listen to and really start paying attention, I guess, to the radio. And for me, with a lot of these reviews, like I did Dookie, it was kind of like some bigger band, and then it kind of, you know, just spirals into all the more underground stuff. So 94 was just that huge year that a lot of stuff broke out. And so a lot of people were able to kind of be introduced to punk rock, you know, at our age.
And yeah, so as Greg alluded to, if our listeners have not yet seen this, we've been running reviews all week long of albums that were important from 1994. Reviews that we have reviewed, or albums that we've reviewed in the past when we were a much greener publication, and they deserved a bit of a revisit at this point and a new write-up. So, John, you I think have been shepherding everyone along for this. You've got a whole bunch of people to write reviews of 1994 stuff. You want to go over a little bit the kind of like the records that have been covered?
Yeah, why not? The staff really bound together. The staff had a great blast with this, and as I should, it's always fun to talk about classic records. I mean, honestly, talking about classic records is probably the second most fun review to write after talking about like super weird records. Basically, I wanted to cover all the classics, so of course we've got Blink 182 covered. When I say classics, I don't mean that John DeTellier thinks there's classics, but that society as a whole thinks they're classics, or if not classics, then at least representative of the punk rock community's mindset at the time. So we got Blink 182, we got Rancid, we got Green Day, we got Jawbreaker, we got Mountain Goats, we got Elliott Smith, we got, let's see who else. I'm missing one or two other big ones. Oh, Offspring. So we got all the heavy hitters and a couple of the medium hitters too. And you say, well, we could review the small bands, and I certainly would, but all the kids wanted to write about the landmark ones. And honestly, you kind of have to get the landmark ones covered before you hit the more underground ones, if you're trying to do a retrospective of a certain year or two decades ago. So I think they're doing a good job. Honestly, I sometimes people get really excited. They're like, oh, this album is the best album ever, and they give it a 10. And I always ask the reviewers, is it as good as London Calling? Is it as good as Damaged? And they almost always say, no, it's not. So it's not a 10. I give out 10s very sparingly. Not that I control what the reviewers write for the review, but I want to make sure the score they give it really is the score they want to give it, not just, oh, this is a good record score. You see what I'm saying? With this one, I was a little looser. They're giving out a lot of 10s. I think Blink 182 got a 10. Green Day got a 10. Weezer got a 10. And personally, it doesn't matter what I think because I'm not reviewing it. But I don't know if those records really are deserving of that score. But because they are such landmark albums, even though maybe Dookie isn't as good as London Calling, from a influence-wise, it probably is as influential as London Calling. So I do think it deserves the 10, even though I would say it's way not as good as London Calling. But the point is, it doesn't matter what John Gentile thinks. The point is, what does the reviewer think, and can the reviewer back up their argument with a good review? And honestly, all the reviewers did just that. So my hat is off to the reviewers who did an excellent job of stating their case and analyzing these legendary albums. And that was really long-winded.
It was. So here we go. So
four scores.
So outside of the things that, of course, we wrote reviews of, what were your personal picks out of 1994?
Honestly, I think 1994 was pretty weak for punk rock. I'm not trying to sound like a dick. I think 1994, honestly, I think like the early 90s were like some of the weakest time for punk rock there was. In 1994, let's see, I know Melvins had Stoner Witch. I don't think Dwarves had a record in 1994. I would say Melvins, Stoner Witch, Ramones had a pretty good album in 1994, I think. And, that's about it, man.
It's like I went and I was looking through through my stuff here to try to figure out like what out of 1994 I still care about.
Adam, like, I gotta interrupt you. Yeah. I'll tell you an absolute classic from 1994. Beastie Boys.
Yes.
Beastie Boys.
Right? That's top of my list.
Yeah, I back that 100%.
And I mean, I'm looking at it, and I think, like, Ill Communication is probably the only thing that I listened to in 1994. From 1994 that I really care. Like
Dookie?
No, I listen to Dookie, I listen to Weezer. I'm just looking at like my personal list here, because there's a lot of records that I really like that came out in 1994, but I didn't get into them until later. So all right, so what do we got here? Mighty Mighty Boss Stones, Question the Answers. That's a good record. I like that. That was 94. But was I listening to it then? No, I didn't listen to that really until I was in the ska in the later 90s. Like Pavement, Crooked Rain.
Yeah.
That was 94. I was
just looking at that. Yeah.
I love that record, but I didn't fucking get into Pavement until like last year. So that doesn't count.
Yeah, college for me. Guided by Voices, B-1000. That was much later.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. New Bomb Turks, Information Highway Revisited, which was the first big New Bomb Turks record that came out. Again, I was super into that, but I was super into that in like the early 2000s when I was really getting into like garage punk stuff. So that, I don't know, I feel bad going like, yeah, I remember that back in 94, because I don't. Same with like Yank Crime by Drive Like Jehu came out that year. But was I listening to them when I was, you know, 14 or 12 or whatever?
I would not have liked that.
I love that record now, but I don't want to like pass off like I have some sort of like childhood nostalgia for Drive Like Jehu because I was not doing that at the time. But yeah, I mean, there was a lot of stuff that came out that year that's cool. But like even that list, there's some punk rock on there. You know, I consider Drive Like Jehu a punk band. I consider New Bomb Turks a punk band, but it's not. Those weren't records that I think were reaching outside of the audience that would have been into punk stuff at the time anyways. And I guess that's why we turn around and celebrate, you know, things like Dookie, because, you know, it was a fucking cultural phenomenon. So, you know, I can get that, although I would much rather listen to, you know, New Bomb Turks or Pavement than Dookie.
Oh man, Frank Black, Teenager of the Year, came out in 94 as well. But again, yeah, I got into Pixies, but it took me a lot longer to get into, you know, the kind of split off stuff from the Pixies. I don't know, it was a good year. They Might Be Giants, John Henry, but I'm a huge They Might Be Giants nerd. I don't think anyone would consider that their best album, but so big for me.
John, I liked how you said, well, there wasn't a Dwarves record that year, so.
there's not a bad Dwarves. Almost every Dwarves record is at least an 8 out of 10, if you ask me. I love the Dwarves.
We know.
They just knock it out of the park every time. What can I say?
All right, well, so moving on to things that are happening now. Although, I guess not, considering the first story that we're going to get into here. Discord Records has announced the release of Fugazi's first demo recordings. So, apparently, after playing 10 shows, the band released a demo, the band recorded a demo of 11 tracks at Inner Ear Studios, and they gave copies away to the show attendees, although the tape that they gave it away only had 10 of those 11 songs on it. So, now that demo with all 11 songs is going to be re-released. The only song from that that's been really officially released outside of that show was In Defense of Humans, which appeared on the State of the Union compilation. So this thing is going to be out sometime this winter on both vinyl and CD. You guys heard any of this stuff? Like, I don't recall In Defense of Humans off the top of my head, but
I have not, but I'm excited for it. I mean, I love early Fugazi. I mean, their first couple proper albums. So I'm pretty excited to look back from there. I mean, they seemed to really bust out of the gate. They had a real solid, you know, kind of philosophy going into it. So I'm sure the stuff, I mean, it might be a little more lo-fi, but I'm sure the songs are all pretty kick-ass.
Yeah, honestly, I've been trying to get into Fugazi for like 5 years, and I'm just not into Fugazi. I really got to focus. People say 13 songs is the one to listen to, you know, and Red Medicine. And I just got to sit down and really listen to those albums. I'm just not that into Fugazi. And everyone says they're so great, so I'm sure they are. But I just got to focus, if you will.
Oh, that's interesting to me.
What is?
I feel like we've discovered something.
That I don't like Fugazi? Yeah, I don't love Fugazi. I could lie and try to be uber punk and say, oh, yeah, I love Fugazi, man. Me and Fugazi, we used to hang out back in the day. But I'm just not that new Fugazi. I will be checking out this demo tape. Discord's been releasing a bunch of demo tapes. They released the SOA demo tape, which I think is better than the SOA album. So, it might be cool. I'll check it out, man.
No, I think it's interesting that your approach to it was just like, you know, you got to keep listening. You gotta figure these guys out, because your persona of the punk historian, you could have just easily been like, "Woo, Fugazi, yeah, classics," and just left it at that. But no, that was
well. The kids demand honesty, and let me give this suggestion to the kids, the listeners out there: is there have been many bands that I've listened to I did not get when I first heard them, only for them to become my very favorite bands of all time. And you can probably guess which bands those are. So don't give up. If someone you respect says a band is good, they're not definitely good, but they might be good.
Basically, John's saying you should all give the Dwarves a chance.
Well, I meant the Melvins, but you should all...
Okay.
Like, the Dwarves hit me right away because the music's relatively simple sounding, and it just rocks. Melvins are a little bit more complex sonically, if you will.
Sure.
Yes. Yeah, so, anyways, yeah, I don't think I've heard any of these. I am excited. I'm a Fugazi fan. I have this. My experience with them is like, you know, like Repeater and 13 Songs, and then everything in the middle. For some reason, for me, I never got to spend enough time with for it to all have its own, I don't know, place in my canon. It's just kind of like the every Fugazi record up until The Argument, and then I love The Argument. I've been continuously in love with The Argument since the moment I've heard it. I think it's just a fascinating record. So
I don't know, would I be on my own saying that The Argument is my favorite Fugazi record? Is that weird?
No, because I think it's mine. It's definitely mine. I mean, like, their early stuff I love, but again, you want to talk about more about like records that like you weren't there for when they hit. Like, mm-hmm. I wasn't, you know, listening to anything when 13 Songs and Repeater came out. So, you know, it was one of those, you know, they're records that I got into way after the fact, but The Argument came out when I was listening to punk, and I was able to like get it when everyone else was excited about it and dig into it when everyone else was, and, you know, look at the reviews that were happening at the time and look at the reaction. And it was, for me, it was much more of like a cultural thing that like, this was our Fugazi record that came out. So
let me put forth a proposition. You see people say, I want a Fugazi reunion. I want a Fugazi reunion. Three part proposition. Would Fugazi ever reunite? Would it be what people would hope it to be? Or Fugazi is almost universally loved band. If they reunited, would there be a backlash against Fugazi?
I think that they could. I don't think that they didn't blow up and split, at least to my understanding of it. They just kind of, you know, they finished doing what they were doing, and then they all started moving around and getting interested in other things and doing other projects, and then that was just sort of it. So I think that, yeah, there definitely could be a Fugazi reunion. Like, they're not going against anything, I think, if they, you know, they're not betraying some past messaging if they did that. But the problem is that this was a band, and these are a bunch of guys that quite famously tried not to make themselves into a spectacle for the sake of money.
Right.
And it's really hard to have a much anticipated reunion, despite your best intentions, without it making you into a spectacle for the sake of money. So, like, you know, are they going to reunite? And I imagine that the problem would be, you know, how do we reunite and start going playing $5 shows like, you know, like we never stopped? Because I'm sure that's what, you know, that's what their heart would want to do. But every show is going to be a complete fucking gong show as far as people trying to get there and scalping tickets and you know, trying to make it into a giant event and profiteer. So if they could find some magic way to do this and sort of like a low key, not making it into a thing about exclusivity or a thing about money way, then I could see them definitely entertaining it. But I don't think they're going to, like, you know, get back together at Coachella.
I'm going to interject something. As you talk about the $5 show, I feel that that ideal they have is an excellent ideal, but I feel, as with many things, the punk community has corrupted it and actually made it a severely damaging thing as opposed to a tool of survival. And I mean it's the following. When Fugazi first started doing $5 shows, that was probably a little on the cheap side, but reasonable. Let me put it this way. In 1981, you know how much a Rolling Stones ticket cost?
$50.
$10.25, right?
Damn!
But that's 1982. That's not 1988, you know? So let's say in 1988, you know, $5 is cheap, but it's not insanely cheap. The problem is punks are like now, like, no show should cost more than $8. No show. I remember when Gilman raised their price from $7 to $8, people protested. Like, are you kidding me? It's like they, the kids don't account for inflation. The reason Fugazi kept it up, and Ian MacKay talked about this in the interview, is they saw it as like a challenge, if anything, just for the whimsy of it, or if not for the whimsy of it, to make sure that they don't violate their ideal that is a show should be fair priced. That means now it's like if a punk show is anything more than like $12 or even $10, people say, you know, they're just doing it for the cash. A $10 punk show is insanely, insanely cheap. Heavy metal shows start at $25. You know what I mean? Right. So I think that ideal, that the ideal is not that any show should only be $5. The ideal is that a band should deliver a awesome show for a very fair price. I think that's been corrupted into the ideal that bands are not entitled to any money at all and should be kept broke and not make money from their shows, but should put on an excellent show anyway, which I think is damaging, and I think it's extremely insulting to artists.
Well, yeah, I mean, $5 show, you're not putting gas in the van to get to the next thing.
But they still have $5 shows.
It must be for bands that don't go anywhere.
Like mine. You know, I would be completely satisfied if Fugazi reunited just to make records. If they're like, you know, screw the live show thing. You know, we don't have this time anymore to tour. And it would just end up being a total clusterfuck. If they just became a studio band, you know, it's like late era Beatles where they're like, you know, we're just tired of dealing with all of this nonsense. We're just gonna, you know, be artists and, you know, create in the studio. I don't know if that would satisfy everybody, but yeah, I just want more music, really.
I'm gonna answer my own question. Fugazi will not reunite. It's the Seinfeld thing, and frankly, it's the smart move. It's the smart move, but it's also kind of the cowardly move. And I don't mean to insult the band, but the look at the following. Seinfeld was at the top. He retired, right? If Seinfeld came back, 99% chance whatever he does after that is not going to be as good as Seinfeld. So it's over. His legend is protected. He will always be Seinfeld. And there will never be like – it won't be opposed to like, say, Willie Nelson, who has ups and downs. Or even Johnny Cash was ups and downs. It will always be this highly heralded thing and will never stop being that. So that's admirable. But in another way – and I've always felt this way. I don't – it's almost cowardly. It's like, well, we were doing awesome. You know what? Let's stop now. Let's not risk it and see if we really have the guts to go forward. And I don't mean to insult the band because they were around for like, what, almost 15 years or something? That's a pretty good run.
Yeah.
But, you know, you have these artists that, you know, exist for a short lifespan and say, well, I'm not going to do music anymore because I felt what we did was great and I don't think we can top it. Well, that's almost kind of cowardly. It's like, take the risk. Lots of bands have been around for that many years and have topped their early stuff. Melvins, Willie Nelson, Johnny – you could argue Johnny Cash's last few recordings are his very best things. If Johnny Cash went by the Fugazi ideal, we would have never gotten those wonderful American recordings. So just something to think about. I'm not attacking Fugazi, obviously, because I like Ian MacKay's band and some of the other stuff too. The Evens. I enjoy the Evens, but it's just something to think about.
See, I don't enjoy the Evens. This is really interesting. Okay, really? I don't want to have a giant
Fugazi. Welcome to the Fugazi podcast.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know. Like I hate to say this because it sounds super dismissive to me, but like the first Evens record, which is I think the only one that I've heard, so it's the only one I'm gonna go on really, it reminds me a lot of the stuff that like I would have saw like acoustic acts doing when I was in university, where like every day you'd go into the university center to get like a coffee or something, and there'd be some hippie kids sitting on the stairs with a guitar singing about oppression or whatever, and it was but it was just kind of like, just like, because it was usually like a male and a female with a guitar doing this, you know, doing these kind of like acoustic protest song sort of things. And whenever I listen to the Evens, despite the pedigree of the people that are making it, like that is the image that pops into my head, and I cannot get that out. And I don't know why. It just doesn't click for me.
But in my defense, I would be against acoustic Evens. I saw electric Evens, and I did enjoy it.
All right. Well, cool.
Speaking of a band that surely has the herald that is as heralded as Fugazi, Anti-Flag have posted a new song. It's called Close My Eyes. and it's off their one of their split EPs they're putting out that to celebrate their 20 years of a band. The split EP series is called 20 Years of Hell. This one is split with Antilectual, but there's five other splits with five other bands. Did you guys check out this song? Are you guys down with Anti-Flag? Did you like this tune?
I was, you know, I never really gave Anti-Flag the time of day. I'm not really sure why. I think that their political stuff kind of came off as like a shtick to me, and they seemed a little too kind of played up as far as the punk angle, the Mohawks, all that kind of stuff. I was kind of past it at that point. But I mean, I gave the song a spin, and I enjoyed it. I mean, it's got a good sound to it. It's catchy. I like the little kind of lo-fi intro. Yeah, I mean, yeah, I didn't mind it at all.
Yeah, I'm the same way on Anti-Flag. I've never really I don't feel like I've given them a lot of a lot of rope over the years. It always seemed like shtick to me. Despite the fact that, you know, politically I'm sure I agree with them more often than not, but there's just they were not a band that would hook me at all. The favorite thing of theirs that I can recall is like a cover of a Buzzcocks song. So that's not great, but I really like this. This is fun. I like this. I don't really have like a huge amount of criticism or any type of commentary or anything to go along with it, but it's a nice kind of clashy punk song. And I, for whatever reason, very much enjoyed it while I was listening to it. So I don't know if, you know, this late in the game, I'm going to go start digging into the Anti-Flag catalog, but, for what it's worth, despite it having the same name of a Slackers song and not being a cover of that Slackers song, I like this.
I checked this out. It's okay. It's not bad. It's I guess as an intro course to punk, it's doing a good job for kids. That's what I have to say about it.
So you're saying it's safe?
I am saying it's safe. It's not bad. I don't hate it. It's not setting my world on fire. But I don't think this music's written with John Gentile in mind. I think this music is written for, you know, 14, 15, 16-year-old kids that are just getting into punk rock. And in a way, that's a noble cause, you know?
Sure.
I feel like there's always like a handful of bands that existed from that kind of like Epiphat punk era, and I guess I'll include Anti-Flag in that we covered because I think we were supposed to cover, but we never had, and by supposed to I mean like it was like obviously we're going to cover Anti-Flag, but I never feel like they had a champion on the staff. And it's, I think they're one of those bands. Like, you know, we had people that championed the Bouncing Souls. You know, like Kira is like the world's biggest Bouncing Souls fan.
And Joe.
Yeah, like we had people that would champion like a Veil. Like when Chris was doing more writing and stuff like that, like Chris Moran was like, you know, like super into a Veil. And you know, similarly for other bands, you know, like Aubin and I were like super into Bad Religion, so we would always, you know, really, really intensely cover Bad Religion and stuff like that. Rancid, and back in those days, Justin and myself were really doing that kind of thing. You know, when we were early on and Scott Heisel was still doing a lot of writing for us, you know, Scott was the one that was really aggressively covering, you know, all these bands that kids now, you know, claim as these fundamental bands. Like he was aggressively recovering a lot of the Midwestern emo stuff. He was, you know, getting like Jawbreaker and Kid Dynamite and all those kind of bands worked
Motion,
into it.
Motion City, I always
well, no, yeah. With I him. Mean, as a new band that he championed, sure. But I just mean like of one of those kind of like early mid '90s. Early 2000s kind of bands were that was really kind of like the meat and potatoes of what punk news was. Anti-Flag, by all rights, should have been one of those bands, but they just, I don't feel like they ever had anyone that was like all that into them amongst our writers. So it was just kind of like, yeah, and Anti-Flag's doing this. And then there was, you know, there was never an impassioned, you know, John Gentile style rant in an article about, about them. I don't know. I guess they missed out because of that, but this song is nice. I'll go there. I can do that. John.
Yes, Adam.
Blowfly. you have had this series of news articles chronicling a certain trial and tribulation in the bluesman's life here. Do you want to give the blowback update or whatever? I was trying to come up with another B word.
I was worried something much dirtier was going to come out of your mouth.
I know. Okay, John, what's up with Blowfly here?
Well, listen, kids, you got to know who Blowfly is. I thought Blowfly was bigger in the punk rock community than apparently he was. I guess 10 years ago he was pretty big in the punk rock community, but I guess people kind of forgot about that. Blowfly is an incredibly important musician. His real name is Clarence Reed. In the 60s and 70s, he wrote a bunch of soul, funk, and disco hits. He wrote Clean Up Woman by Betty Wright. He wrote stuff for Casey and the Sunshine Band, and he's got his own solo career. You guys know Clean Up Woman or Girls Can't Do Like the Guys Do? You guys know that song? It's one of the most beautiful songs ever. It's the song that goes, "Girl, you can't do what the guys do and still be a lady, girl." Like, it's one of the most recorded songs ever. The story is, though, is he could never really make it big as his own, and he wanted to do something unique. So he created this alter ego persona called Blowfly. And what Blowfly does is he does original and covers, but really, really filthy songs. And he's got, like, Rainy Night in Georgia is Spermy Night in Georgia. He's got a song called Blowfly's Rap, where it's just one of the filthiest rap songs you ever heard. And the songs are really funny, and Blowfly is great live. Well, he's very good live. But the problem is, the tragedy of his career is the following, is Blowfly has never been super rich. So in the late 80s or early 90s, he was hard up for money. So he sold the rights to all his compositions, Clean Up Woman by Betty Wright, his own stuff, Casey the Sun, for basically like pennies on the dollar. You know, they never said how much, but probably less than like $5,000. Beyonce, Jay-Z, and Kanye come along, they all sample them. Those samples are worth hundreds of thousands of dollars each. If he had held on to those songs for a few more years, he probably would have been a millionaire. If not a millionaire, set. He's an older gentleman. He would have been set for the rest of his life. So he's broke as hell. His mother died a little while ago, and he lived in his mom's house. The problem is the tax assessor was sending the tax bill in his mom's name to the wrong address. So he never got the tax bill. So he was behind on his tax bill by about $10,000. And the tax assessor was threatening to foreclose on his property. So his manager / drummer / announcer, Tom, set up an Indiegogo campaign to basically raise $10,000 to prevent foreclosure on Blowfly's house. I was quite happy to see that he was able to raise $10,000 and pay off the foreclosure threat of his house, pay off the tax assessor. So I guess crisis has been averted. It looks like they're setting up a way to make sure it doesn't happen again. It raises an interesting issue. Blowfly, I'm telling the kids, you need to go listen to his Clarence Reed songs. You need to listen to his Betty Wright songs. Some of the most amazing soul music you'll ever hear. You need to listen to his Blowfly songs. He's recorded with Jello Biafra. He's recorded with Tesco V of the Meat Men. The old school punk rockers love him. The issue is, it's a tragedy because this is a guy that should be worth millions, if not millions, at least like a million, and he doesn't even have $10,000 to pay off his tax bill. The question is this, is why doesn't he have his money? In a moment of weakness, he sold the rights to his music for nothing. So you can say, well, I got to pay my tax bill. Blowfly should have to pay his tax bill. Why should I help him out? He should have money. And it's a good question is, do we owe recording artists, I guess, the benefit of, I don't want to say charity, but I guess compassion, if they've made very poor business deals and are now broke despite being written some of the most famous music in the world despite being sampled by Beyonce and Jay-Z? You have to factor into that Blowfly is not a businessman. You know, he's raised in the South. He's not educated. So can you say, Blowfly, you're stupid for selling the rights to your songs? Can you criticize him for that if he was never educated in business or even rights of music to begin with? It's a very difficult question. But on the other hand, if you save Blowfly's house, why shouldn't you save the house of any number of other people that are facing foreclosure right now?
Vanilla Ice.
Well, see, Vanilla Ice is different, you know. It's a very difficult question, and I don't have a direct answer for that. I lean towards the side of compassion, say, Blowfly has brought me so much joy through his music, then I'll give him some money. And actually, I did. I went and I saw him live, and I bought a – he's got an awesome T-shirt. It's a like, I don't know if anyone knows Celtic Frost, but they have an album called Return to the Emperor, an EP called Return to the Emperor. And it's got, like, this Viking with, like, three buxom ladies. I think it's painted by Boris Vallejo. Well, they did a parody with Blowfly on the front, and it's really funny. And they've got an exclusive live album. So you can buy merch from them, or you can just go see them live, or you can just donate money to them. So I lean towards that. But I'm not sure that that's the right answer, and I use "right" in parentheses or quotes. So,
yeah, I guess. Sorry, go ahead.
No. I got something, but you go.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I guess I'm kind of conflicted. I'm not really sure what I think about the whole thing. I mean, I guess I do have a little bit of a problem with the Indiegogo just for paying off his taxes. Well, I would have preferred.
Let me interrupt you real quick, Greg. You could get some stuff, like an album or whatever, but it was like $80 for an album, you know? So it's
okay.
You see what I'm saying? So it's essentially a donation, you know, like WHYY.
Right. Yeah, I guess that's what I was going to say. If you release some, like, exclusive tracks or something like that, and you're essentially just paying, you know, more than you usually would, that would go towards his money troubles. And I think probably, I mean, my problem there, I didn't click over to the Indiegogo thing, and that's probably, you know, a lot of people that are commenting on this story did the same thing, and they're complaining about it just like, you know, well, what about me? Well, but if you're getting something in return for it, I don't have a problem with it.
So what I was going to go at is that there are other creative industries that you can look at to see, you know, what do we do about, you know, the early creators who are in need. So the kind of obvious example for this is something called the Hero Initiative. Now, the Hero Initiative is a thing that's in the comics industry. It's a 501c not-for-profit. And what they do is it's a consortium of comic publishers today that are trying to give back and create a financial safety net for comic creators that produced stuff back when, you know, the contracts were really predatory and when, you know, there wasn't a... When the work that they were doing wasn't really seen as something that was going to last and make corporations money for a long, long time, like back when comic creators were doing stuff really early on, they would, you know, give away their rights to all sorts of stuff all the time for really like a pittance of money. And so a lot of these guys that were like the early artists and the early writers of these comics are having all sorts of, you know, normal old people medical problems and financial problems these days. But, you know, they didn't necessarily profit from the fact that, you know, they created whatever, Green Lantern or something like that, to actually, you know, have that support them. So what Hero Initiative does is they do various fundraising and stuff like that to get money to go and to help people. So like, I mean, like folks like, I'm just looking at their list here. Yeah, okay, like so like Steve Gerber, who was he wrote Superman stuff, he wrote Spider-Man, he was the creator of Howard the Duck. So like Steve Gerber up until his death in 2008, he was supported via the Hero Initiative for various like medical and living expenses because he was fighting with what was it? Like pulmonary fibrosis or something like that his work as a creator would never be able to, you know, afford him that care. So those sorts of things exist. So if there are people like Mr. Blowfly that, you know, are people that we want to, I don't know, as a community support, and they, for whatever reason, didn't have the wherewithal to get that support from their career creating, you know, there are models out there for how that can be done.
It's interesting. I never heard of that.
Yeah, so I don't know. That's like heroinitiative.org if anyone actually wants to look that up. But yeah, so they do work to basically like help those folks who need help that helped create the stuff that people are still enjoying today.
Sort of along those lines, and this is easy for me to say, but I'm thinking, you know, Beyonce made millions of dollars off the single she sampled for Blowfly. Well, Clarence Reed. Couldn't she just kick him 10 grand, you know?
Well, yeah, okay. We're talking about that level of money in an individual's hands, probably.
I mean, like his sample is like what made it. Like it was like her first really big hit song. I forget which one it was. It's a Clarence Reed composition. Made her millions and millions. Couldn't she kick the guy 10 grand? And maybe she did. You know, I don't know. But that's easy for me to say. I mean, her perspective is I bought the song from the owner. You know, it's not my fault. He made a bad business deal. So I don't know.
So
I put up my $25. Let me just say that.
And yeah, that's good, John. I don't know what else to say.
You're a good man.
You're a good man, Charlie Brown. So so what do you think? You want to play a song?
Yeah, Adam, take us away with a song.
Oh shit, me. Okay.
Well, I can go if you want me to go first. It makes no difference to me.
You go.
All right. So anyway. Punk News has a wonderful community. We have lots of wonderful commenters, readers, and emailers. And I got an extremely nice email from Rich White out in the UK. He lives out – where's Robin Hood from? Nottingham.
Sherwood Forest.
Well, Nottingham. I guess Sheriff Nottingham. That's where he lives. And he sent me an email. He's like basically he said, oh, you know, I really like the podcast. I love it when you guys, you know, play old stuff and talk about old stuff. I was like, oh, that's cool. Are you used to being the punk rock scene or something? And it turns out he did. And it turns out that Rich used to be a what do you call the guy? An engineer, basically. Not necessarily a producer, but an engineer. And he had a small studio called Rich Bitch Studios. And while he was there, he recorded a band called Decadence Within. Nobody knows about this band. This band's pretty rare. However, they were played on the John Peel radio show, and John Peel was a fan. So, and the track was recorded by Rich White, and I think a couple of his friends, too. They recorded an EP called the Speed Hippie EP with this band called Decadence Within. It came out on Floating Gerbil Records, and actually looks like it was the very first Floating Gerbil Records release. That might be Rich's label, and it might not. I'm not sure, honestly. But this band is kind of neat. This band was around in 1986 and after then. They didn't put out an album until like 89, I think. But it's kind of a combination of thrash, goth, and anarcho-punk. And it's interesting because when we think of thrash, we don't usually think of the UK. But, I mean, there were thrash bands in the UK. So I think this track is really interesting. And honestly, I think Rich, like this is from 1986. The sound on this recording is awesome. So they did an awesome job recording it. This is Decadence Within off their... a Speed Hippie EP, and it's a combo track. It's called Chase the Dragon / Atrocity by Decadence Within. We'll be right back.
right, we're back. John, that was really cool.
You ain't finding that one on YouTube, baby. That's a rare one.
So, yeah, so, well, thanks for the letter.
Rich. What's his name? Rich White.
Rich. So thanks, yeah, Rich. Yeah. Yes. If anyone wants to email us, podcast@punknews.org, and you can do so. There's a few people from the UK who get in touch. There was someone, I've been really late in posting the past four or five episodes, and one of our guys in the UK emailed me, and he was like, hey, where's the podcast? I was like, I suck. I'm sorry. And whenever anyone does that, I always remember that, like, someone listens to this, and that's weird. So, anyways, let's keep going with things that are happening here. Sick of It All. We debuted the new single from the New York hardcore Stalwarts. I never say stalwarts in real life. Is that even pronounced?
Stalwarts. I never say it either, but it's a great word.
It's one of those words that I like writing, but like in conversational English, I don't think I ever would use it. So anyways, the song is called Road Less Traveled. It is, in the words of Mr. John Gentile, who I wish was here to comment on this, a classic hardcore smasher that is ragged, raw, and really fierce with gang choruses, thumping bass, and buzzing guitar. So anyways, you can find the link to this thing on Punk News. It's the track off their upcoming record, The Last Act of Defiance, which is due out on September 30th on Century Media. So yeah, new Sick of It All song, and it's pretty awesome.
Adam, you're like, I wish John Till was here to speak about it. For a minute, I thought I was in that that scenario, like Twilight Zone, where I'm dead, but I don't know it. And so I go around talking to people, and they don't acknowledge me, and I just think they're being a jerk, but it turns out I'm a ghost. Anyways.
No, that is what happened.
Oh, well, there you go. This is John Till coming from you beyond the grave to talk about Sick of It All. Anyway, this track is cool, man. If you remember, we talked about Sick of It All about 2 weeks ago. I was like, yeah, it's cool or whatever. Man, this track is banging, man. This track kicks ass. I'm excited for the new Sick of It All album. Maybe it's not reinventing anything, but honestly, it's really classic, really well done, classic New York hardcore. This is cool.
I was playing this in prep for the podcast, and like as I said on a few shows ago, you know, I like this band. I've always liked this band, but you know, I'm not a fan in that I'm like following all their material and their releases. They're a pretty prolific bunch of guys here, but man, yeah, I love this. This is great. This song is really good. It's really fun. It is exactly what I wanted to hear when I hit play. So. This is cool. I know some of our commenters were like, you know, I wish hardcore bands wouldn't sing about hardcore.
Yeah.
As the subject matter of their song. And I get that. And what are you going to do? These guys have always kind of done that. So you just got to take it at this point.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't really care for Sick of It All, honestly.
This didn't seem like a super Greg Simpson kind of band.
No, you know, I mean, I'll listen to the really classic hardcore stuff. You know, I'm not a hardcore completist, but when I listen to hardcore, it's usually early 80s, not, you know, late 80s, 90s. I guess the whole kind of New York hardcore scene, I just kind of
Sick of It All is pretty early 80s, aren't they? At least like 86.
I'm looking there. Their first album was 89. I mean, I guess they were around before
they,
that.
They formed, yeah, way around for a while, 86, yeah, yeah. But, I mean, very well for your opinion, Greg, but I enjoyed this single.
Yeah. I mean, the production sounds really good. One guy mentioned the bass. The bass guitar sounds really fucking awesome. But yeah, just like, I mean, I like my hardcore with a little bit of melody. I like the melodic hardcore a lot more than just the straight up.
When you say melodic hardcore,
throat screaming the whole time.
Do you mean melodic hardcore or do you mean like Black Flag? Because when people say melodic hardcore, people think of Kid Dynamite. Is that what you mean, or do you mean?
I think it's probably more like that kind of stuff,
like Kid Dynamite.
But, well, I like both of those kind of things. It's got to have some semblance of melody in there, or at least a break for melody at some point. Like I can't survive on just riffs, really. You know, I know you love your riffs, but
yeah, actually, Greg, I think that is the fundamental difference between you and I. I do love the riffs, and you are not as much of a riff maniac. Adam, where do you stand on riffs?
Hmm. I'm pretty much up the middle there. Like, because if I was more of a riffs person, and this is the most profound conversation we've ever had on this show. if I was more of a riffs person, I feel that I would be into metal more. But like, I find most metal just like totally boring. So I gotta say that I'm probably in the middle. I probably fall a little bit closer to Greg on the scale here. Although, man, if the next Outdoor Velour record had a cover art with a snake eating a rat eating a snake, you could maybe then capture some of this power.
I've debated about, so, you know, throwing a curveball there with some really brutal artwork. I've toyed with that idea. And then it's just the most twee stuff ever when you put it in.
This is Outdoor Velour. Emo is on lockdown.
I, for some reason, am really enamored with the cover art.
It's cool, man. Well, speaking of bands with interesting cover art, Against Me, they've announced a live album, they've announced a book, and they've announced a documentary.
What do we got?
Oh, I'm sorry, what was that, Adam? Oh, never mind. Frontwoman Laura Jane Grace said this. It's crazy because at this point, having 6 studio albums and a bunch of EPs, there are almost a good 100 Against Me songs. To have this lineup we have right now and to feel really strong about the way we're playing and to see these songs that we've been playing for a long time, they've evolved over the years. The idea is to take the best of the best and put together a 25 to 30 song record that can reintroduce some of the songs in their present form and really try to capture what happens when we're on stage. I saw Against Me this past winter. I've never been a huge Against Me fan. The new record, I think, is the best record. I really do. I think it's the most punk rockish. I could be wrong, but I think it is. I saw them live, high energy, you know, full throttle punk rock show, more or less. I thought this is great. I think, and I love it when bands do live albums where the song on the live album is way different than their studio version. You know, Bob Dylan, Melvins, who else does that? Rolling Stones. A lot of bands do that. So I'll get this, man. I'm looking forward to this. The last Against Me record, I'm still not a huge Against Me fan, but the last Against Me record definitely made me an Against Me fan. And the live show, too.
Now, they've already put out a live album, correct?
Yeah, in 2005.
Okay. So then, I mean, yeah, the lineup's quite a bit different now. I guess half different, yeah. Drummer and bass player. I mean, are they gonna have some of the same songs that were on that one? I mean, how different could those songs be? It just seems like there's going to be a lot of retreading.
It could be, but Bob Dylan made a career out of that. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. If you look at Bob Dylan's live albums from the 60s to the 70s to the 80s, the songs are so different. Highway 61. The Ballad of a Thin Man, ISIS.
You know, I mean, Greg, normally I feel that I'd agree with you, but I think that, like, I mean, like, Laura's personal change notwithstanding, this band's been through a lot of stuff since that last live one came out. Like, that last live one was the, I want to say, that was the last thing that Fat put out before their major label release.
Yeah, I'm looking at it. It is on Fat, 2006.
Yeah, Or it may have come out just after that major label release. It may be, like, I don't know if it was like the last thing in their contract for Fat when that came out. But they've been through a lot. They had that whole major label phase, for better or worse, and they're, you know, and they've had all the personnel changes. So, you know, it's probably a good time. If their live show is hopping right now, then it's probably a good time to capture that again, because they are a different band.
It's hopping. I mean, it's not Ramonesy, but, you know, like, song after song after song, almost every song's high tempo. And Greg might be distressed to hear this, but melody has been given away for energy.
Well, the albums still have melody.
Oh, Greg, you and your sing songs that you like.
I know.
All right, so next story here is a Mischief Brew story. John, this is right up your alley, so I'm going to get some commentary here. So a band called Kettle Rebellion, which is the three-piece band that existed before breaking up and reforming as Mischief Brew, has announced a reunion show that's going to take place on October 11th in Philadelphia with the group's original lineup of Eric Peterson, Chris Culp, and John Foy. There's no venue or anything that's been announced at this point. This is going to be Kettle Rebellion's first full show as a band in 12 years. They briefly reunited last month for two songs, and earlier in the year, the group finally released their long-lost and only recordings, which date back to 2002, as the self-titled release called Kettle Rebellion. So John, this is up your alley.
This is right up my alley. This isn't big news, I guess, for the punk news as a whole, but it's very interesting news. Punk News actually was lucky enough to be able to cover the Kettle Rebellion release. Basically, we had the exclusive stream for the Kettle Rebellion release when it was released this year. The story behind Kettle Rebellion is very briefly the following. They recorded a album in 2002. Eric Peterson had some squatter punk kids stay at his house, and they stole the master recordings from him, and they put it up on Soulseek. So they lost the album. They just got so mad they broke up. And then later on, he reformed his Mischief Brew with Chris Culp, but not John Foy. And so, like, basically, Kettle Rebellion was pretty much doomed to be one of these bands that, like, no one ever talked about or even cared about because no one really knew about it. They only played like 5 or 6 shows live ever. Well, it turns out that between Eric Peterson, Chris Culp, and John Foy, they actually had the whole album. They just had different tracks in different places. So they put it back together. They had Punk News stream it, which was a real thrill. And so, you know, it's basically the pre-Mischief Brew band that's halfway between, like, Mischief Brew and subhuman-style anarcho-punk. Maybe a little bit of anti-sect stuff there, too. Last month at the Nightbirds Subhuman show, they got together for 2 songs, which no one expected. We've got a review of that. You can check that out. And now they're just going to do a whole show, probably just for fun. I'm super excited for this. I'm definitely going to go. This isn't going to change anybody's life, but if you're into this kind of thing, it's going to be a really awesome, fun show.
Is this something that within, like, Philadelphia is big news?
In a way, yes. I guess with regards to Mischief Brew, Philadelphia is like San Francisco. Outside of Philadelphia, people know of Mischief Brew, but they're not huge. But, like, I saw the Mischief Brew open for Subhumans in Philadelphia. I saw Mischief Brew open for Jell-O. Better example. So I saw a Mischief Brew open for Jell-O about a month and a half ago. And Jell-O was awesome. The crowd was so into it. The crowd loved it. Mischief Brew, the crowd was just as into Mischief Brew as they were Jell-O Biafra. And Jell-O never comes to the East Coast. Well, he does, but like once every 2 or 3 years or more, you know. And Mischief Brew plays here every 6 weeks or so. So locally, they're a very popular band from within the punk community. And as well they should be, their music has a lot of melody, if you will, and the songs are very well-composed songs. It's not
melody,
just,
you say?
It's not just speed, you know. Like, the songs are fundamentally awesome songs. So this probably will sell out.
Cool. I've never heard them.
Well, so the next story here, we got... So the Foo Fighters have callously named their new record... Oh, I feel like our story has changed. I was going to give them a whole bunch of shit. I could have swore I read this differently. Anyways, so the Foo Fighters have detailed their new album. Their 8th LP is going to be called Sonic Highways, and will have a mere 8 tracks, although those 8 tracks will clock in at 44 minutes. The thing was produced by Butch Vig, and it's coming out on November 10th. Follows up a 2011 release called Wasted Night. No, what I was stopping myself there was... I could have swore that they said it was going to be called Sonic Avenues.
Yeah, me too. But I guess we must have been wrong, Adam.
But good, because fucking Sonic Avenues is a good band, and they don't deserve to have their shit stolen by the Foo Fighters. So, let's talk about Sonic Avenues. Sonic Avenues are a punk band out of Montreal. They're great. They got this kind of like power pop thing going on. They've released a record called Mistakes this year on Dirt Nap. It's one of my favorite records of the year. It's probably way better than this Foo Fighters album. Holy fuck, you should go listen to Sonic Avenues. So let's talk about this Foo Fighters record.
Wow.
There's 8 songs on it. It's 44 minutes long. I'm going to see if I can find out how long Sonic Avenues Mistakes is and how many songs are on it. And we're going to do some math because I'm pretty sure it's not going to have that level of bullshit and cruft involved.
Well,
so.
Well, while you look that up, Greg, Adam, me and Greg will have a short chat. Greg, the Foo Fighters are a very popular band. Are they a very popular band because they're very good? Or are they a very popular band because they are the last big rock band and people go to see them just because there's really not that many rock bands anymore?
It could be a little of the latter. I do think they have a handful of good songs per album, but there definitely does seem to be a little filler on the more recent albums, which kind of troubles me about this new one. You know, the filler quotient is going to be way upped if these songs are super long. Like, I feel like Foo Fighters aren't very good at, you know, kind of tastefully drawing something out and maybe gradually building to something. I feel like they're the band that's at their best when they're just big all the time. And that definitely doesn't call for long songs.
Do you think these songs will be like heavy metal songs, like, or they'd be like Bruce Springsteen extended ballads?
Jeez, I don't know. I mean, yeah, I mean, like I said, the rockers are usually the best stuff with the Foo Fighters. I don't know if there's really many ballads of theirs that I like. As far as metal goes, I don't know. What do you mean by that? Like actual metal, or just like the way a metal song will go on and have lots of solos?
Like, let's see, what's 44 divided by 8? That would be 22 divided by 4, 11 divided by 2. So each song is almost like 6 minutes long. That's like a Metallica album.
Right. Yeah, I don't know. We'll see. Sounds kind of troubling to me. And it seems like a kind of an odd thing to kind of, you know, as the press release to be like, oh, look, we got these long songs. It seems like kind of an odd way to pitch an album.
Or it could be very avant-garde. It could be David Bowie, Station to Station.
It's going to be a bunch of, like, tape loops and shit like that. That'd be cool.
Yeah, I'm not mega into the Foo Fighters. Actually, I'm not really into the Foo Fighters. I just don't like – I mean, Dave Grohl seems like a cool dude. Actually
What?
He's the nicest man in rock and roll. Haven't you heard that?
Yeah, but Buzz Osborne called him a dick once, and I got to side with Buzz.
As you always would.
I'm glad Pat Smear is making some bank, because I'm sure he didn't make any money with the Germs. So good for Pat Smear.
So Sonic Avenue's record, Mistakes, is 11 songs. It's got to be about like 24 minutes long or so. So one more song. No. What? Fuck. Three more songs in half the time. So anyways, I'm being stupid. I don't actually begrudge the Foo Fighters anything. They feel like a band from a different era.
The 90s, you mean?
Yeah, well, just not so much the 90s, but like there's still big radio-friendly bands that play big arena shows that are out there. But I think, like, by and large, most of them that have emerged in the last several years, they don't have – they're not able to both, I think, you know, like, please, you know, the masses and kind of have critics – not necessarily on their side, but I guess, like, you know, give them their due. Like, no one's gonna give a shit if there's like a Nickelback album that comes out, right? Except for like the masses that will like Nickelback, and then like everyone that's in, you know, the more of the critical music realm are not. The Foo Fighters, they kind of live in the middle of that because they've been around. They're from that era. They have that connection to Nirvana, blah blah blah, right? So, I mean, like, there's people in that band, like Pat and everything, that have, well, even Dave, that have all sorts of, like, genuine, real connections to, I think, an era of music that a lot of people still respect and pine for. So I get that there's going to be a forever replenishing well of goodwill to throw the Foo Fighters' way. And I think, like, at their worst, they're just kind of easy to dismiss. But they're not offensive.
They're not bad.
Yeah, and I mean, like, someone... Oh, I'm trying to remember the analogy that I heard the other day, but it was... that I read about what band they compare them to from the 70s. But you know, they're...
Nazareth?
No, I'm trying to... Shit, I'm losing it. I don't remember what it was. But they make competent stuff that, given their stature as a band... They have, like, as of late, way overblown, and they make these giant albums that I don't think people are that infatuated with them this late in their career that a 44-minute album of 8 songs on it is going to necessarily, you know, change a lot of people's lives. It's not going to, you know, it's not going to have any kind of huge cultural impact. But hey, if that's what these guys want to do, then that's fine. I mean, again, the worst thing is that they're easy to ignore.
Is it Aerosmith? Is that who you're thinking of?
I'm trying to remember what it was. I got to find this out because it was a good analogy. In that, like, the Foo Fighters are kind of like competent but forgettable.
Well, Adam, while you're doing that, let me wrap this up, and then maybe we can bring it back around to the band that's competent but forgettable. A band that is not competent but unforgettable, but not competent in the very best way possible. One of their protege, CJ Ramone. I'm speaking of the Ramones, of course, but CJ Ramone is going to release a new single on Fat Records. The A-side is called Understand Me, and he's got a pretty crack band with him. He's got Dan Root and Steve Soto of the Adolescents. Dan Root also played with Keith Morris and Bug Lamp, and he's got David Hidalgo Jr. of Social Distortion. The B-side is a cover of Black Flag's Rise Above, and it's got Dez Cadena on guitar and background vocals. And, of course, a lot of people always say, why is Dez doing Rise Above? That's a Henry song. Actually, though, Rise Above was written while Dez was singing for Black Flag, and they played it live with him before Henry Rollins joined the band, and Henry Rollins went and recorded it. I checked out the single. I dug it. I wouldn't say it's the greatest thing ever, but I enjoy it. And honestly, at this point, I'm glad just anybody with any Ramones pedigree at all is putting out music.
This is a good song. Like, I gotta say, like, the recording here, I really enjoyed. And I don't know if I was expecting to not enjoy it, but, like, to me, like CJ is the Ramone that I have, like, the least amount of immediate recallable knowledge about
what about Richie?
Okay, Richie and CJ.
How about Elvis?
Oh God, okay, fine. this is trivia time.
Who is Elvis Ramone? Quick.
I don't remember who Elvis Ramone was.
He played with them for one show. That's Clem Burke of Blondie.
Oh, huh. Shit. Okay. So, all right. So, Elvis aside, I'm not going to count him. You know, like CJ's like pretty far down the list of you know Ramones members that anyone is expecting anything from. Well, four of them are dead, so that's probably why the others. But but you know what I mean. It's just like. I don't know. I didn't expect to see that Fat was going to turn around and sign him to the point where, like, I wasn't even aware that he was doing stuff or releasing music or anything like that. I mean, he's certainly not as visible as Marky's been. So upon going to listen to this song, and this kind of comes up with any of the Ramones that are still surviving that were not the original Ramones, of course. You got to wonder, like, how much of this is them trying to capitalize on the fact that they were in the Ramones compared to how much is this them actually creating something genuine. But while that said, I like this. The song is fun. It sounds nice. It's, you know, it's good.
Question. Did CJ write anything for the Ramones during his tenure?
Yes, he did. He did The Crusher.
Yes.
And actually, that's
honestly, a good song.
And actually, if you listen to the live version off Adios Amigos, and I think there's also one other live disc, the one with the hand-drawn cover, it's a cool song, you know? Like, it's a good song.
Mm-hmm.
Great commentary, John. It's a good song, you know? It's a good song.
Which is what I just said about this new recording. So, it's a good song. Yes.
It's like, good, guys.
God, we're the worst people to comment on music at all, ever. Yeah, I mean, like, CJ was in the Ramones during an era that I think I'm, like, mostly unfamiliar with. Like, there's not a whole heck of a lot of, like, the post-89 Ramones stuff that I've ever paid a lot of attention to.
I was wrong, though. He did not write The Crusher, but he sang.
Oh. Yeah.
So I think it's that, where it's just, you know, he's the also-ran of the Ramones in my head, but... That said, this song is good. I like this, so I don't want to talk shit about it. I'm kind of looking forward to hearing this now.
What do you guys think of? I love the fact that they're bringing in Dez Cadena to do a Black Flag cover. I just wish it wasn't Rise Above because he already did that with the Misfits, you know. So I mean, why not have Dez do another Black Flag tune? But it's cool, man. I'm actually probably going to buy this. And well, it's not like this is salespodcast.org, but Fat is only asking like $4 for it, which is extremely reasonable.
Wow.
Oh, I just found the cover art to the Foo Fighters' Sonic Highways, and it's like a CGI rendering of a bunch of famous buildings. It looks like it's part of a video game.
It looks like it's the SimCity 2000 cover.
Does not bode well.
Quick, we need more electricity and water pipes. Okay, okay, Dave Grohl.
I love SimCity.
Crime is down. Good job. Here's a statue. Thanks, Dave Grohl.
Oh, yeah.
It looks like they were trying to go for a Hypnosis cover. You know, Hypnosis did all those Pink Floyd album covers and stuff. But it really just looks more like SimCity 3000. Crime is down.
All the major cities squashed into one another. It's pretty crazy.
So, hey, I mean, I don't know. Maybe this Foo Fighters record is going to be good.
Well, SimCity 2000 was good.
SimCity 2000 was good.
Truth.
Speaking of things that are good, Adam, do you have a good tune for us? Is it The Crusher by the Ramones?
I could not get clearance for The Crusher, so much that I tried. All right, so here's my story. This is really the story about how I am an indecisive old person that is unable to do anything interesting because I'm lazy and old. So, you may have heard of this band that I talk about all the time called the Constantines. I talk about them just slightly less than John mentions the Melvins each podcast. So anyways, they're doing a reunion thing. They're around playing shows in Ontario right now. I got tickets to their big show coming up in Toronto in October, so that's fine. I've secured that. Now, next weekend, they're taking part in a music festival that's in Ottawa, Ontario, the nation's capital, called the Arboretum Music Festival. So they're headlining the Saturday date of that music fest. So I got it in my head. I'm like, oh, you know what? I should go up there and see them play that thing. Now I was looking at the schedule, and also playing that show is the Steve Adamic Band, who we've actually played in this podcast before and are a great little punk band. And that evening, after the main kind of gig is done, there is a little show that is being done in town that's going to feature a bunch of bands that I like. So it's going to feature the Dirty Nil, it's going to feature Grays, it's going to feature Witches, and then it's going to be the album release show for a band called New Swears. And I'm going to play a New Swears song in a minute. But getting back to the fact that I suck, I look at this and I say, I should go to the Arboretum Music Festival and see these bands that I like and talk about all the time. That would be something that a person that likes those bands would do. But, you know, that would involve me buying a ticket to the show and then going to the show. And the issue being that Ottawa is like 6 hours away.
Damn.
So, people I know who are not lazy assholes, they do that shit because they like music. And I can never make the mental connection to actually fucking do that. I was talking to someone the other day, and he was like, oh, I just came back. I was just in Boston yesterday. I went down to see, there was some big hardcore thing that happened in Boston. I don't remember what the name of the festival was. But he's like, I drove down from Niagara Falls to Boston to see the show, and then I came home. Boston is like a 7-8 hour drive from here.
Oh, the Boston beatdown.
Yeah, or whatever it was, right? So I'm like, and I'm looking at him like he's from the fucking moon and going like, you actually like got in a car and like drove a extremely long distance and then came home, and it wasn't like you didn't justify the extremely long drive by going, well, I'm going to be here for a week. Like, no, you went there and you watched some bands and you came home. And people do this. But I do not do this because I constantly talk myself out of it by being a fucking asshole. So I'm going to do this next week. I've bought the ticket. So
yay!
I am going to get off my ass and drive to Ottawa. And I'm probably going to hate every minute of it because I got to drive the fucking 401, which is the most boring highway on earth.
So how long of a drive is it?
It's probably between 5.5 and 6 hours, depending on traffic.
Yeah, that's a healthy drive.
It's a drive. I mean, gas is cheap these days, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, real cheap.
Yeah, real cheap, right? So what the fuck? It's easy. Yeah, no problem. Cheap gas, and you know, 10 hours worth of driving so I can go watch like 4 hours worth of bands playing. It seems like it makes, that's a good deal. So anyways, I can't talk myself out of it now because I've already bought the ticket. So anyways, that's coming up. This is a really long intro to a song, isn't it? Playing the final gig of the Arboretum Music Festival is a band called New Swears. Now, New Swears is a... They had an album come out last year called Funny Is Not Real. And it was really super fun. It was a track that came out... the LP came out on Bachelor Records, and it was also released by Bruised Tongue Records as a tape and Dirt Cult Records as an LP. So it was a very kind of shambly, Black Lipsy, party punk kind of record. So their new one that's coming out at this thing is going to be called Junk Food Forever, Bedtime Whenever. So that is the New Swears new upcoming party punk record coming out. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to actually play you a song from last year's record that I'm a big fan of because it's super fun, called Liquor Store. So this song is called Liquor Store. It is by New Swears, a garage punk outfit from Ottawa who is playing the Arboretum Music Festival, who I'm going to go see because I am going to Ottawa and I can't talk myself out of it now. So here it is. Okay, we're back. That was a really long intro to a song.
I bet your intro is longer than the song.
It probably is. The song's what? I like short songs. It's 2 minutes and 46 seconds long. So yeah.
Yeah. Probably. It's like triple the length.
Oh, I wonder if I'm going to see Transplants Mark while I'm in Ottawa.
So we have you on tape saying that you're going to Ottawa. So yes.
Huh. Yeah, I figured that me saying it on the podcast would make it real. I'm just not young anymore, Greg. Kids do this stuff.
Yeah, you know, all my All my friends have been going to Riot Fest in Chicago, and I'm just finally, after like 3 years of my friends badgering me, I'm finally doing it this year, so I'm getting off my ass. Even though I'm only going to one of the 3 days, I'm like, I'm only going to one of the three days of this thing. Yeah, I'm chalking it up in the win column.
Well, I don't need to go to Riot Fest because Sam Hain's coming to me. Yeah.
Not all of us live in
Philadelphia!
Yeah. So. So what I'm thinking is that maybe this is going to be a brand new era in my life. Maybe I'm just going to start driving all over the fucking place to go to shows.
Adam, what if you quit your job and your business and become a road tripper?
Yeah.
And like people follow Adam's adventures on the road.
Yeah, clearly, now that I have like a mortgage and a kid, this is the proper time for me to start driving all the fuck over the place so I can go to shows.
Seems like the responsible dad thing to do.
It does. This is maybe some sort of quarter life crisis thing that's happening. I don't know. Like, your shackles can't hold me. I'm going to Ottawa. Get in the car.
Man, honestly, I bug out after like 2.5 hours, 3 hours. I'm like, oh my God, I'm so sick of driving. FYI.
I know. I did too. I thought about taking a train, but. And I like the train because I can actually like sit down in a train and do work on a laptop and stuff like that. Big fan of the train, but I don't know, that means I have to have like more accommodations and everything because the train will, you know, it's not going to sync up necessarily with my schedule. It's going to mean I'm out there for a couple days.
I feel you, bro.
I know. Transplants, Mark. Transplants, Mark's going to be there. I betcha. At least in Ottawa.
You guys can meet up.
We should
talk about transplants.
He won't hear this. Well, he will. Hi, Transplants Mark. Coming to your town. Oh, this was a show. Okay. Anyways, thanks, Greg. Thanks, John. Thanks, people that put up with this. If anyone wants to email
us. Thanks to Rich White for sending us this extremely rare tune, because I love playing the rare and old stuff on the podcast. So, Rich, thanks again. I am digging this single.
Yeah, so if anyone wants to email us again, it is podcast@punknews.org. If you like this show, please go rate it on iTunes because that helps us. So, yeah, that's it. We're done.